You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
It's History Wednesday.
Yes.
Just continuing our history series on Puritanism with Dr. McKenzie. Thanks to Concordia University, Wisconsin for supporting The Coffee Hour. Find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin at cuw.edu.
Live uncommon.
Joining us today, the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We continue the saga of the Puritan movement, because it really is a saga. And now we're moving back into, we're going to go back and look at what's happening politically. So what happens, Dr. McKenzie, when the monarchy is restored?
Yeah, good question. First of all, let's realize that the parliamentary army side worked really hard to try to figure out a good way to maintain the polity of England without a monarch. Oliver Cromwell was a pretty strong and important figure, but when he died, his son tried to take over, did not do a good job, and before you knew it, the army was kind of divvying up England under particular different generals, so it looked like you might even have a civil war between parts of the army. In the wake of Oliver Cromwell's death. And one of those generals, a fellow by the name of George Monk, along with some important prominent civilians, saw that the best thing for England would be if they could negotiate a deal with the son of Charles I, namely Charles II, and bring him back as monarch. And so some negotiations were opened up. Charles II was willing to come back, and he was willing to come back not as an absolute monarch, the way his father had tried to rule in the 1630s, but as a constitutional monarch, the position that his father had accepted as of 1642, no taxation without parliamentary approval, none of those prerogative courts that the king developed on his own. But instead working with Parliament, not the way it is today, but nonetheless the way, much more than the way it had been before. So now how do they do this? This is kind of interesting. Well, remember that the Long Parliament was the Parliament that was technically still in session, even though it wasn't meeting. So Monk, the general, resummoned the Long Parliament, and the Long Parliament authorized the election of a new parliament, and then they voted to dissolve themselves. So the Long Parliament is out in 1660. They've called for the elections of a new parliament. That's called the Convention Parliament, and that's the parliament that invites King Charles to return. Before he returns, he's issued a declaration for Breda in the Netherlands. And in this declaration, he promises that he is going to give religious liberty the way Cromwell had done it in England. And he's going to pardon all those who had rebelled against the monarchy, with the exception of those who had killed his father. He did not pardon the assassins of his father, the regicides, if you will. And he also says that, of course, whatever he wants to do in these matters will be subject to parliamentary authorization. So back he comes in May of 1660, not by force, but by parliamentary invitation. As Charles got back, everybody was out in the streets hailing him, glad to have him back. So he said, well, his subjects were so obviously glad to see him, it must have been his own fault that he'd been away so long. At the time of his return, Charles II was about 30 years old. He had spent his entire adult life in exile, sometimes as a fugitive. Unlike his father, who in his own way was idealistic and noble, the son, Charles II, was much more cynical and selfish. He was ready to accept the world as it was rather than the way he wanted it to be. But he was also very eager to figure out how he could get something out of it. He's also different from his father in manners. His father was reserved, above the fray. He was a king, not a chum. But Charles II was friendly, easygoing, a real people person. but not necessarily honest in his dealing with people. He would use people for his own purposes. Unlike the father, Charles II sat on the throne for the rest of his life. Also, unlike his father, Charles was guilty of reversing policies, betraying allies and friends, and of lots of double dealing. So we enter a new period in English history during the reign of Charles II that's called the Restoration. So the question is, what were they going to do with religion? Well, the convention parliament under Charles II tried to deal with this, working out some kind of arrangement whereby Charles's promise could have been kept regarding religious liberty. There was a problem, however. In this convention parliament, there were not only Puritans, but now supporters of the Church of England had also been elected, and elected in large numbers. Now, these folks had been out of power and had basically been oppressed by the Presbyterian independent Puritan parliamentary forces. Their clergy had been forced out of their livings. They had, because they had refused one aspect or another of what kind of religious settlement was being imposed. A lot of them were regarded as martyrs. They were not particularly interested in being nice to their former opponents, the independents or the Presbyterians. Most of the Anglican bishops had really done very little except keep quiet during this interregnum period, but there were a couple who had proved to have strong sense of integrity and had maintained a kind of an Anglican position. There were preachers who kept using the Book of Common Prayer. On the continent, a fellow by the name of John Cousin was a bishop, and he continued to minister to members of the Queen's household. So these folks are coming back. They now have access to power, and they're not interested in making any compromises with their enemies. Now, they probably on their own weren't enough to keep a compromise from taking place, but they were assisted by the independents in this convention parliament over against the Presbyterians. The Presbyterians worked hard with Charles II to establish a broad Presbyterian church, and this compromise would have kept bishops, but bishops would have done their organizations with also the leading clergy. Those clergy who had been placed into office without a bishop could keep their office. The Book of Common Prayer would be recommended, but it wouldn't be mandatory. So the Presbyterian, there's a big effort to compromise between the king and the Presbyterians, but neither the Anglicans nor the independents wanted that. And so when this thing was brought before the convention parliament, the compromise lost. So what was to be done? Well, they voted, the king decided to have a new parliament. And this parliament came in, I think it was 1661, and this is dominated by Anglicans. This was such a good parliament for Charles II that he kept it in existence for 18 years. It's known as the Cavalier Parliament. And when it came to religion, the Anglicans were in the driver's seat. And they were not making compromises with anybody. So, what did they do? Well, they passed another Act of Uniformity. And what did that Act of Uniformity do? It imposed the Book of Common Prayer once again on all the churches of England. It was virtually the same Book of Common Prayer that Queen Elizabeth had authorized. A few tweaks and so forth, but basically the same services, the same book, now once again, the law of the land. They also insisted that all clergy should subscribe to the 39 Articles again. They also insisted that all clergy had to denounce that solemn league and covenant, which had set up the Presbyterian establishment. And this was the kicker, all clergy who were not ordained by a bishop had to get ordained by a bishop or else they would be deprived of their jobs, kicked out. And the result of that last thing was that about 1,000 of the Anglican clergy, or I should say the clergy in the Church of England, were expelled from their livings, from their jobs. This was known as the Great Ejection. Thousands of them out. And this meant that their congregations and members who were loyal to them were also, in effect, excluded from the church. Now, the Parliament tried to keep a division from happening. Oh, yeah, the clergy are going to be kicked out. But they passed laws like the Corporation Act, which meant that any person who was a nonconformist would be deprived of government office. It also meant that no one could legally attend another kind of church service besides that of an Anglican. It also passed something called the 5 Mile, which no ejected pastor could come within 5 miles of his old church. So it was an attempt really to restore Anglicanism and to make it once again the only legal church in England. It just didn't work. There were too many people who had it with this kind of stuff. They weren't going to obey. Some guys were thrown into prison, that's true, but a lot of other congregations and pastors continued to serve people. And we now start to get, during this period, even though it's illegal, we start to get the formation of these denominations, Presbyterian, Congregationalist, and Baptist. So,
that's a good place to maybe pause for a second.
Yeah, let's
see. Yeah, and we can take a break here. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, we believe you were created for a reason, to use your God-given gifts to help others, to live a life of self-sacrifice in a me-first world, to live a life that's uncommon. Whether you're taking one of 50-plus online programs or learning with us in person on the shores of Lake Michigan, you'll be equipped to make an uncommon impact. Learn more at cuw.edu. Concordia University, Wisconsin. Live uncommon.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about this time with Charles II and the Act of Uniformity imposing all of these things back onto the churches in England. And before the break, you mentioned that there was a formation of all of these denominations. What happens then with all of this turmoil happening with the churches in England?
Well, they're illegal, but they are developing. And Charles follows a religious policy, which in some ways was helpful to the religious dissidents, but in other ways got him into a lot of trouble. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, on a couple of occasions, Charles tried to suspend the laws imposing religious uniformity on the people of England. Now, Cromwell, in the previous period, had permitted a good measure of religious liberty, and on a couple of occasions, Charles tried to go back to that. But why was Charles trying to go back to that? Well, Charles, for lots of different reasons, was following a pro-Catholic policy. So if the king granted religious liberty to the Congregationalists, he's also granting religious liberty to the Catholics. So let me explain a little bit about this. We're not exactly sure when Charles became, spiritually speaking, a Roman Catholic. But on his deathbed, he did convert to Catholicism. So there's some period of time he becomes a Catholic in his kind of attitudes and approach. Furthermore, he doesn't always get along with the parliament. They don't always vote enough money for him the way he would like it. So he actually, in 1670, negotiated a treaty with his cousin, the King of France, Louis XIV. I mean, probably some of your listeners know Louis XIV as the great sun king, the great absolute monarchy of pre-revolutionary France, and he was, but he's also a first cousin to Charles II. And in this treaty, Louis, the King of France, agreed to pay Charles V a huge annual salary if Charles would promise to reintroduce Catholicism into England. The agreement said, and I'm going to quote it here, "The King of England, being convinced of the truth of the Roman Catholic religion, is resolved to declare it and to reconcile himself with the Church of Rome as soon as the state of his country's affairs will permit." So there's that as soon as thing in there, but this is what Charles had committed to. Now, it's a secret treaty. I mean, nobody knows about this in England except a few people who are particularly close to the king. So Charles is getting this annual pension for a few years. It was like 50% of his income that he is getting from the King of France. And among other things, he has promised to convert the country, convert himself, and to work at converting the country to Catholicism. I will mention also that there was foreign policy involved with this, and that Charles agreed to help Louis in his wars on the continent, which were ongoing. And I'll mention that there was a religious element to these things, where Louis XIV is fighting against the Netherlands, and their leader is the stadtholder of the Netherlands, William III, who's kind of the champion of Protestantism. So you've got these wars of religion on the continent, and Charles, as part of the Treaty of Dover, has promised that he's going to help his cousin in that warfare. Well, no matter what Charles actually intended, it didn't work out. In 1672, he issued what was called a Declaration of Indulgence. And by the terms of this indulgence, he announced that he was not going to enforce any of the penal laws directed against Roman Catholics or the nonconformists, the Baptists, Congregationalists, and Presbyterians. Instead, the Catholics would be free to worship in private, and the nonconformists would be free to have public worship if they would obtain a license. So what the Declaration, in a sense, was doing was legalizing what was already happening in a lot of places. But nonetheless, there were a number of critics in the parliament who wondered how in the world the king had the right to suspend a law simply if he didn't like it, especially when those people saying suspected that maybe Charles II was trying to move England back to Rome. Well, in the wake of this second declaration, there was a great furor in the parliament, and the parliament forced Charles to back off from this and even forced Charles to agree with a piece of legislation that was kind of the opposite of what he had intended, and this was known as the Test Act of 1673. In order to keep the king from doing something like this again, Parliament passed a law, and Charles, going along with the political situation, accepted it. It was called the Test Act. And what the Test Act did was to make communion in the Anglican Church a test of political rights. Anyone who wanted to hold office in England had to take the Lord's Supper according to the rites of the Church of England and to state publicly his opposition to transubstantiation. So what the act did was effectively to make sure that no Catholic could really serve in government, because no good Catholic could accept that kind of arrangement. Now, what about other Protestants? Well, you know, their conscience wouldn't be quite so bound. Maybe some of them could take communion in the Anglican Church without worrying about it too much because they didn't accept the body and blood. So it was easier for Protestants to go along with this of all sorts than it would be for the Catholics. This was the Test Act of 1673, really kind of infamous for making communion a test of whether you have political rights and can serve in the government. Now, when this thing was passed, some people already in government resigned. And this was kind of surprising, especially when the Lord High Admiral of the Navy resigned. Now, why was that surprising? Well, he was not only the admiral, he was also the brother of Charles II. And not only the brother, but the heir to the throne. So in 1673, it was discovered that the king's brother and heir was a Catholic. This set off a huge furor. Basically, James had to be persuaded to go into exile for a while in order to let the anxiety kind of die down. But it was a very big deal. And as a matter of fact, subsequent to that, the Parliament tried to pass legislation excluding a Catholic from the throne. Well, just kind of a side here. The first political party to actually organize in the Parliament of England was a group who organized especially for the purpose of electing members who would vote for the Exclusion Act to keep James the Catholic from inheriting the throne. These became known in history as the Whigs. They were successful in their campaign, but Charles II, in order for a law to be a law, the king had to accept it, and he would not accept decision. So, well, I mentioned kind of how adamant he was in not accepting it. When the act, it's got to pass through Commons and Lords. It passed through the Commons, went to the Lords. Charles II went down to the House of Lords and publicly debated it against the, yeah, right. So he's not a very principled guy, but he was principled when it came to the dynasty. Now, there's something else that's kind of ironic about that, and that is the fact that Charles had all kinds of children. He was one of the most sexually immoral kings ever to be on the throne of England. He had something like 15 mistresses at various times, and all kinds of children, but by his wife, he did not have a child. And so it's his brother who is the heir to the throne, and not he. So Charles's policy is dynastic, it's religious, it's also political. He wants to help his cousin, but on account of politics, he has to give up helping his cousin. He doesn't give up the money, and he finds it impossible to reestablish Catholicism by means of a declaration of indulgence. Now, there are some other interesting things I want to talk to you about here, but we are probably going to be running out of time. What do we have, a couple of minutes left?
About 2 minutes, yep.
Okay, so there's a very interesting episode that takes place during the reign of Charles that illustrates the antipathy of Protestant England to Roman Catholicism. This is an episode known as the Popish Plot. And it involves a guy by the name of Titus Oates. And Titus Oates was just a strange duck who had been expelled from school and then passed himself off as an Anglican clergyman and a chaplain in the Navy. And then he gets caught and he's thrown into prison and he becomes a Catholic and he goes over the continent, tries to get into a Catholic seminary. He's thrown out of that. And then he comes back to England in the late 1670s and says that he has learned through his contacts with Catholics that there is this terrible plot by the Jesuits to assassinate the King of England and put on the throne James II, a Catholic. And so this becomes an uproar. Members of Parliament buy into it, and they're afraid, and Jesuits and Catholics all over the country are being arrested. Probably about 20 or 30 of them were executed as a result of these charges. Meanwhile, Oates is brought before the King's Privy Council. That's the council, the kind of executive council of the king. And Charles discovers that he's lying. He talks about talking to the Regent of Spain. Charles knew the Regent of Spain, but Oates couldn't even describe him correctly. It was all a lie that Oates persisted in until he was discovered. He is brought into court for libel against James. James wins the libel case. It's like £100,000 that Oates owes. And then the next year, he's convicted of perjury and thrown into prison for life, which doesn't last for life because there's a change of monarchy in 1688. But I think we should talk about that change of monarchy next time.
Very good. We will stop there. We'll continue the story next week. Our guest today, the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, thanks for joining us today. Great history.
Thank you. I enjoyed doing it.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.